Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Jason Leopold, who spent 2 years covering California's Enron electric power crisis. He was the Los Angeles bureau chief for Dow Jones Newswire, and he's been working for the last years cultivating sources close to the CIA leak investigation, and he's a regular contributor to Truthout. And Jason broke the news last Thursday with his article, Cheney Spearheaded Efforts to Discredit Wilson, which revealed information from well-placed sources that the vice president's central involvement in the campaign to discredit Ambassador Joseph Wilson. And we'll be looking into that story and whether or not the special prosecutors will be targeting the vice president or he is vulnerable in any way. We'll also speak with Joseph Rizzioni, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Deadly Arsenals, and we'll be talking to Joseph Rizzioni about the apparent collision course that the United States and Iran is on in terms of Iran's clandestine efforts to develop a nuclear weapon, and it's breaking the seals and kicking out the IAEA. And we'll look into whether rhetoric on both sides is serving the Iranian government and the Bush administration, and whether this dangerous rhetoric could create a war fever, particularly one in this October, just before the elections. And then in the last segment, we'll talk about the budget with Greg Speeter, who's executive director and the founder for the National Priorities Project in Washington, D.C. We'll be talking to him about the federal budget, which is the White House just released. We talked to him about President Bush's record-breaking $440 billion defense spending allocation, which does not include the cost of the Iraq and Afghan wars. And we're looking into what that $2 trillion estimated by some people would have bought as opposed to being sent down a black hole. I'm speaking with Jason Leopold, who, as I mentioned, spent 2 years covering California's Enron power crisis here in Los Angeles. He was the bureau chief for Dow Jones Newswire. Now he's been a regular contributor to Truthout. And last Thursday, he broke the article entitled Cheney Spearheaded Effort to Discredit Wilson, which revealed information from well-placed sources as to the vice president's central involvement in the campaign to discredit Ambassador Joseph Wilson. And, of course, it's pretty clear that Scooter Libby is going to use his boss as a defense. And I guess, Jason, the question is, the vice president, it's unusual for a vice president to arbitrarily declassify, but it's not illegal, right?
That's correct. It's not illegal. Basically, this is information, in terms of the National Intelligence Estimate, which they had, or I should say, which Scooter Libby alleges that the vice president had authorized him to leak. It's not illegal to do that, since it's the president, the vice president, who that's information. There is an authorization that allows them to, give this out to reporters. However, it's highly unusual because it was given out to specific reporters who have been known to be defendants of the administration's intelligence efforts or intelligence apparatus in terms of the buildup to war. Judith Miller is this particular reporter from the New York Times, and who has a long history of writing stories that were very favorable to the administration and during the buildup to the war. However, with Cheney's involvement in discrediting Wilson is something that has not been seen. Many officials that I've spoken to, they have not seen a vice president personally get involved in a campaign to destroy the reputation and the job of an individual who is a critic of the administration. And this was a very, very long effort to do that.
Well, of course, leaking to reporters, albeit friendly reporters, is not the normal way classified information is declassified. There's a process that is there. But just to cover that for a moment, what do you know was leaked? Because that NIE was a pretty bogus document.
Correct.
And it was massaged heavily by Doug Feith's Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon. I spoke with Senator Graham about this fairly recently.
Yeah.
And he was extremely critical of the process. And he called for the original NIE, but then the OSP manipulated it. So I take it that probably what was leaked to Judith Miller was the most inflammatory claims probably coming from OSP, right?
Exactly. And you're right, by the way, in what you said, that there is a process in place. I mean, normally if you're going to declassify material and leak it to reporters, or just declassify it in general, you go to the CIA and you let the CIA know. You don't do it while it's not illegal. You don't take it upon yourself to just declassify, you know, material just to rebut allegations that the administration had a flawed intelligence. So this was definitely, absolutely, without a doubt, intelligence in this NIE that was just the caveats were removed. The may or possible, instead showing that Iraq was a nuclear threat, and what we know now is that all of the information, all of the intelligence in that national intelligence estimate was just absolutely bogus. And it really, it's interesting that, you know, in the story that I had written on Thursday that came out showing how Cheney, you know, and Libby, and even Stephen Hadley, who was at the National Security Council at the time as the deputy advisor, had really gone above and beyond the call of duty to make sure that the fact that they had pushed these Niger claims, you know, they weren't exposed. And on top of that, it's interesting that the Washington Post then had a story by this former CIA officer, official.
Paul Pillar, right.
Yes, exactly. All of these things are interconnected. Now, you know, I certainly didn't have any plans to run my story as when the Washington Post ran their story. But the two are absolutely connected, because this was the campaign to discredit Wilson took place in early March 2003, 2 weeks before the war started. And at this time, the international community was trying to get the United States to just allow the inspectors more time to to look for these WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. At the same time, the International Atomic Energy Association was, Mohammed El-Baradei was out there saying, these documents are absolutely bogus. So
these are the Niger forgeries.
The Niger forgeries. At the time, before they were called forgeries, these Niger documents were bogus. They absolutely cannot be relied upon. So this was an effort to cover up an extraordinary amount of intelligence that was absolutely wrong, that did come from the Office of Special Plans, but also came from this, White House Iraq group, which all of the officials who were involved in the discrediting of Joseph Wilson were a part of.
And that's where the Whig met. That was a group that, with Rove, Libby,
yeah,
doing the politics,
yeah,
Matlin and Karen Hughes doing the spin,
yes,
and Hadley and
Andrew Card as well.
Andy Card chaired, yeah, it, and I believe Condoleezza Rice and Hadley would do the politics,
yeah,
or policy,
exactly,
for the want of a better description. Now, let's talk about the workup that was done, not just on Wilson at these meetings, that apparently now we know that Dick Cheney was taking an active, and Prack was, in fact, directing these workups. They also did a workup on David Albright, did they not?
They did,
he's a weapons inspector that preceded David Kay.
Correct, and, you know, David Albright was, right, that preceded David Kay, and David Albright was, you know, somebody who was critical of the fact that, that the administration appeared to be dead set on, you know, going to war, that everything that they were saying was just, was just lip service in terms of the so-called threat. Now, David Albright happened to be on this CNN broadcast with Joseph Wilson, March 2nd, 2003, and had really, called into question the veracity of the intelligence. But in addition to that, had, you know, said that the weapons inspector should be given more time. This I mean, these people that I spoke to, I'd like to, you know, the listeners to know that if I were to reveal their identities, these are very well-known individuals who have been, whose names would be familiar. These are people who are absolutely disillusioned at this point of the flawed intelligence that led to war, but also of the of what's currently taking place in Iraq. So they just felt the, I urged them to go on the record. They felt the need to speak out. But early on, when David Albright was out there criticizing the, along with other people, criticizing the administration, Cheney and Libby and Stephen Hadley had used the CIA to collect information that can be used to discredit these individuals. In some instances, they made up out of whole cloth allegations against Joseph Fulton and David Albright that were just not based in reality. They saw these people as a threat to the administration's credibility, and they wanted to shut them down.
Well, just in terms, though, of the leak story, apparently there's something of a witch hunt going on inside the White House that Bush and Cheney were absolutely freaked out by this NSA leak that the New York Times was sitting on for a year.
Right.
And then the editor and the publisher of the New York Times went to the White House, the Oval Office, and Bush begged them not to publish. They published because their own reporter was going to publish his book. But apparently they've been quite vindictive about this while this becomes the Senate and having hearings, etc.
Sure.
The long and the short of it is they apparently take this very personally because somebody senior inside that circle, that tight circle, leaked this, and they want to find out who it is. And I believe the FBI is getting close to finding out this person. So if you're talking to senior people on the inside who are disillusioned, it sounds like a very toxic environment.
It really is, and I have to say that I have another story coming out next week as well on this very issue, on the, in addition, on the leak and a little more info on what Cheney and Hadley's role is. But let me make this clear that it is a very, very toxic environment right now, and there are many, many individuals who would be considered, and still are to some respect, hawks. They absolutely played a part in pushing for pushing intelligence that they knew to be flawed in order to win public support for war, who are now wanting to speak out but are obviously afraid to put their names on the record, but they are absolutely leaking more and more information. I find it to be very hypocritical that when Valerie Plame Wilson's identity, the CIA undercover operative, when her identity was leaked, that President Bush in October 2003, when asked about it, he said, well, this is a quote, I'm quoting here, this is a town full of leakers. I don't know if we'll ever find the leak. Apparently, this person's job, this person's life was not important enough, whereas now, with the leak of the NSA spying, that is absolutely, we have to find the leakers. So apparently, the town full of the people, Washington being a town full of leaks, seems to, it's a different story when it has to do with something that obviously hurts the administration. And I think that this is a perfect example of individuals who are whistleblowers who should be protected, whereas with the Joseph Wilson, Valerie Plame Wilson situation, these are individuals who leaked her identity are not whistleblowers, nor do I believe they should be protected.
And in this case, the leaking, albeit a double standard in terms of leaking information that they wanted to get out, came from Cheney himself, and we know that Cheney, Bush, and Condoleezza Rice were making extraordinary public statements about the smoking gun becoming a mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
So they were actually even ahead of the press in terms of their exaggerating, and that's all clearly on the record. There was also a workup done. We're talking about the vice president's vindictive activities here. You think he'd have better things to do, but going after Wilson, going after David Albright. But also, it's interesting to note that Paul Pillar, that you mentioned, the senior chief analyst of the CIA, who just quit and is now going public in an article in Foreign Policy magazine.
Yeah.
where he mentioned, is it Foreign Affairs, I'm not sure, but where he says that they cherry-picked the information and that the real story was that they had made up their mind to go to war and they didn't care, they just wanted anything to justify a decision that was already made.
Right.
But they didn't make any, there was no strategic thinking involved in this. They were absolutely so determined to go to war that nobody looked at the big picture, which has led to this strategic blunder that's led to this black hole.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing that's shocking. But it's interesting to note that they also did a hit on Paul Pillar, and they used the same conduit, Robert Novak.
Right. Yes, he is. And again, these are... There are a handful of reporters who the administration had believed were would be sympathetic to their cause. These are individuals like Robert Novak, like Judith Miller, and some others that they could count on to be stenographers, if you will, and write stories that would be favorable, that would obviously shut down these critics. And the aluminum tubes is a perfect example. The first meeting that the White House Iraq Group had, in which they said that we have to publicize the threat that Iraq posed. Their very first customer, if you will, was Judith Miller, and it was the aluminum tube story. And once they fed her this information, then these very same individuals went on all the Sunday talk shows holding up her story as evidence. So, I mean, they really duped people here. I mean, and the thing is that we've obviously, for the listeners of your show and those in who dig deeper than the New York Times and the Washington Post, there's long been speculation that of course this may not seem like news. The difference is now that we actually know it for sure. Now what we have is the evidence. There's no longer speculation. There's actually people who are willing to say it. And I guarantee you that in the months ahead, there's going to be more information. The question is, what do we do with it at this point? What should happen? And the fact that this is this is beyond a blunder. This is criminal. This is criminal, and there should be some sort of repercussions that happen to this administration, because at this point they're basically doing and whatever they want to do, and the more that we expose them, we in the in the journalism community expose the crimes, and I use that word literally, that people need to some people in power and government need to start doing something about that to hold them accountable.
Well, them specifically in this case being the vice president, who was hands on. I guess the other shoe that is yet to drop is who forged the documents,
right,
and whether or not this is a case of the White House, at least the vice president's office, not finding the intelligence they wanted, and
yeah,
then finding a way to literally feed bogus intelligence back to themselves. And that, of course, is impeachable in terms of malfeasance.
Yes, and also, by the way, it's under the radar right now, but the FBI is, in fact, has picked up the investigation again into the Niger forgeries to find out exactly how that happened. In addition, the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, is sort of trying to build a timeline here to show why the administration had motive to the various individuals to go out there and discredit Wilson and leak the identity of his wife. And in doing that, he's building a timeline around the Niger forgeries, and we're actually getting some information on how that actually came about. He's not looking to prosecute or question the validity of the war, but rather to show how this specific intelligence really was the silver bullet that won the administration's support of Congress and the public in backing the war. And this is, what maybe 2 or 3 years ago may have sounded like conspiracy theory, if you will. This is actual fact. These are, there is so much information in the public domain right now. I mean, just as a perfect example is the documents that Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, had publicly released, which has to do with Scooter Libby's, Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, his case involving the leak, in those documents, there's some explosive information there, whereas Libya is actually saying, I was authorized by my superiors to go out and do this. That's unprecedented. So, you know, the fact that this is sort of, you know, still at the grassroots level is a little troubling, because I believe that it should be splashed all over the front pages of, you know, of the major newspapers and magazines. But we are going to absolutely see a lot more information come out, and we're going to learn that the president, the vice president, Dick Cheney, played more than an active role. He was directly involved in the campaign to really shut down any critic, and in certain aspects had actually authorized leaking and calling their actually discrediting these people and ruining their lives.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Jason Leopold.
Thank you, Ian.
Good to talk to you. I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Jason Leopold, who spent 2 years covering California's Enron electric power crisis, and he was the Los Angeles bureau chief for Dow Jones Newswires at the time, and now he's a regular contributor to Truthout. And last Thursday, he broke the story with an article entitled "Cheney Spearheaded Efforts to Discredit Wilson," and that revealed information from well-placed sources that the vice president's central involvement in the campaign to discredit Ambassador Wilson and the former weapons inspector David Albright. And as we mentioned, also the senior CIA officer who's just retired and is now speaking out about the cherry-picking of intelligence. He's also the recipient of a hit piece by Robert Novak, who appears to be the vice president's favorite reporter, since he was the conduit that was used to out Valerie Plame, Ambassador Wilson's wife. I'm now speaking with Joe Cerezioni, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and the author of Deadly Arsenals. And, Joe, you just got back from Geneva. And what do you think is Iran's motives, given that by provoking this crisis, by removing the seals, the IAEA seals, they inexorably are heading for a showdown with the Security Council with the possibility of sanctions, and certainly they're provoking the Israelis into a preemption of some kind, and they may well be also providing the White House with a kind of October surprise scenario in terms of creating a crisis in as a lead up to the next election, where there's indications that the Republicans may lose the House and Senate.
Well, this isn't the first time that a political leader may have miscalculated his way into a military confrontation. I don't believe that is what President Ahmadinejad is planning. There's lots of motivations for this. I would think the primary one is domestic at this point. This is, remember, an unpopular regime. The people of Iran have long chafed under this theocracy that's been governing them. Ahmadinejad represents the most extreme element of the Islamic movement in the country. He has the economy is faltering. His policies, for example, on banning Western music are highly unpopular. This is the one issue he's got going for him, and I think it's probably surprising him how well it's working. He is having speeches before tens of thousands of Iranians cheering for nuclear power. There's no other country like this in the world at this point, and it's merged with this entire is Muslim mood provoked in part by the cartoon crisis, provoked in part by the Iraq war. So he's really tapped into something here, and he's riding it for all it's worth.
And why do you think it is such a hitting such a nationalistic chord?
Well, remember, it's not for nuclear weapons. All the demands are for nuclear power. It's for Iran's right. They feel that this is another case where the West is trying to deny them their rights, and in this case, the energy of the future. The West, the United States, says that nuclear power is the energy of the future. Then why can't Iran have it? That's the way the issue is framed internally, and that's the way Ahmadinejad has...
But the deal they have with the Russians who are building this nuclear power plant, the one and only nuclear power plant in Bushehr that they have, the deal originally was that the Russians would take care of the fuel cycle. So
yes,
nobody's denying Iran nuclear power.
That's exactly right. And that's still the contract. Iran is legally obligated to buy its fuel for Bushehr from Russia. So that's still the contract. And there is no real economic sense for making their own fuel. Usually...
Yeah, they don't have much uranium anyway.
20 reactors to justify that kind of expense. So it's almost purely...
And Russia's got nothing but surplus of fissile material, so...
Yes, that's right. And of course, you know, there are some, and I would say Ahmadinejad is one of them, who want to use this as a means of acquiring the technology for nuclear weapons. I honestly do not think that the regime itself has decided yet whether it wants nuclear weapons. They're a long way from that. This is not a military crisis in that sense. It's not a nuclear bomb crisis. It's a nuclear diplomacy crisis. Iran is still a good 5 to 10 years away from the ability to enrich uranium, either for a reactor or for a bomb.
And Joseph Rizzani, you recently were in Iran, and you went on an inspection of these very facilities that are in question.
Yes, I was down at Isfahan at the plant where they turn the uranium. Iran has uranium deposits, and they mine it and mill it and bring it to Isfahan, where they are trying to learn how to turn it into a gas. It's that gas that would then be put in the centrifuges, spun around, and enriched for fuel or for weapons. And they're still at a basic level. They still haven't learned how to do this. The gas they've been producing at Isfahan, which they restarted about 3 months ago, is still too impure for use in centrifuges. That's part of the technological reality they face. So a lot of the talk you hear about going to commercial production on enrichment and going all out is just Iranian bluster at this point.
So they still, I mean, they can't mill the uranium sufficiently fine enough to be used in the centrifuges, and they can't make the uranium hexafluoride.
Right. The milling is the easy part. Lots of people do that. Almost all uranium mines in Niger, for example, you mill it right there. It just makes sense to take the junk you don't want and concentrate it into what they call yellow cake. But then converting it into a gas is it's technologically demanding. Very few countries do that. And then enriching is something that only 7 or 8 countries in the world know how to do. Almost all the countries that have nuclear reactors don't enrich. They buy the fuel from the countries that know how to do it.
And just one, 7 parts per thousand inside the yellow cake are the isotope U-235. So it's an onerous process. Now, I understand that they have the Pakistani-developed AQ Khan's supplied them on the black market with centrifuges. They don't have enough of them.
No, they don't.
You have to have thousands in a complicated array. They spin at 70,000 RPM, so they're very highly engineered. And they have an outside and an inside baffle, so it's a kind of complicated piece of engineering.
That's exactly right, and they've got 164 of them now. The Iranians have 164 that they bought through the Pakistan network, and they haven't gotten those to work yet. And what you need is about 1,500 or 2,000 working for an entire year to make enough material for one bomb. If you want to supply that Bushehr reactor, you need about 50,000 working. So they're a long way from that kind of capability. They can do it. It would just take time.
But again, we're talking about not the reality, which is what we've just discussed. We're talking about the unreality, which is rhetoric, which is coming from the Iranian leader and coming from the White House.
You know, at this point, Ahmadinejad and Bush are mirror images of each other. Both of them are using this issue for domestic purposes. Just as you said, the Bush administration, you know, stirs this up, generates this, one, because they honestly are concerned about this crisis, but it plays well for him. It continues to be part of this domestic agenda that creates or exaggerates the threats that are out there to show that he's the warrior president that can defend the nation from these hostile forces. President Bush does it in America. President Ahmadinejad does it in Iran.
But let's talk about the reality of any kind of military action. I mean, we don't know exactly what the Israelis are up to. The Israeli press has been reporting that the F-15s have been exercising, that they may have a base now in the Kurdish north of Iraq, which is fairly close to Iran. On the Iranian side, the Iranians are saying that the British are stirring the pot down in the oil-rich province, which is the part of Iran where all the oil is, which is what Saddam tried to grab, which became the Iran-Iraq war. And that's the theory, that the West, the Americans and the British, and the British, of course, are in Basra, right next door in Iraq, would militarily seize the oil fields. That seems to me to be absolutely far-fetched, because it's pretty clear that even if U.S. military that's overstretched as it is in Iraq would agree to, obviously they have to follow orders, but even if they'd agree to going to war against biting off more than they can chew, it would be insane, wouldn't it? Because the Shiite Iraqis behind their backs would shoot them, because the Shiites in Iraq have made it clear that if a war broke out between the United States and Iran, they would side with Iran.
Well, as a matter of fact, in Tehran just a few weeks ago Mokhtar Sadr, the head of the Sadr militia, whose units have now integrated fully with the police and Iraqi military forces in the Shia south of Iraq, and he said that if Iran was attacked, he and his militia would defend Islam. That was his quote. By the way, would also fit his political domestic agenda in Iraq. He's got his own conflict with Shia leadership. Ayatollah Sistani, for example, is more moderate than he is. So this, of the military scenarios that people talk about, the first one is what you describe, sort of an invasion, a full invasion or a partial invasion. I agree that that's almost certainly not what's going to happen. It's beyond our capabilities at this point. We're already bogged down in Iraq. We would be resisted. There'd be no illusion that we'd be seen as an army of liberation. The second, that was actually sort of war-gamed out in an Atlantic Monthly article last year, and that the Pentagon is known to have war-gamed out, is a sustained strike of several days with 300 or 400 aim points that would target the entire Iraqi facilities, some of which, like...
The Iranian facilities, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Some of which are hardened underground at Natanz. That also, I think, is unlikely. But there is a possibility of a limited strike at... My target of choice would be Isfahan, this uranium conversion facility. It's above ground. I've been there. I've seen it. Lightly defended, few anti-aircraft, nothing that we or the Israelis couldn't handle. But here's the problem. What does Iran do next? You hit that facility. You set back the program. That's true. But there's a half dozen things that Iran could do, all of which are terrible, including actual military strikes. Probably not likely. More likely the Shia militia would rise up and jeopardize the already fragile U.S. position in Iraq. The Shia-dominated government in Iraq could say, that's it, we want you out. We could just be forced out politically, not even militarily. The Iranians could take military action, for example, restricting traffic in the Straits of Hormuz. Anything like this would, of course, put the price of oil up to $100 a barrel, gasoline up to $5 a gallon, triggering economic consequences for the West, perhaps serious economic consequences. And then
they could also unleash Hezbollah in southern Lebanon.
Then there's those unknowns of Hezbollah. There is all these talk, of course, of Iranian cells and embassies around the world. There's that kind of possibility. And, of course, this is exactly what Ahmadinejad in some ways would like. This plays right into his hand, because it unites the Iranian population around what is generally an unpopular government, and
But isn't that the tragedy in this, Joseph Razziani? Before the United States invasion of Iraq next door, the Iranian people had the mullahs on the ropes.
Yeah.
They were the young and the women are just chafing under this reactionary repressive regime with their religious police who are harassing people, and the students were getting particularly bold. Obviously, Khatami, their leader, didn't really step up to the plate. He had more of a mandate than he really exercised. But the minute that the United States blundered in next door, it completely undercut the Iranian opposition. And there's no way in the world that the Iranians want to be liberated by the United States after what's happened in Iraq. So it seems to me that this is the real tragedy here.
And this is a very under-discussed part of this. The missed opportunities we had over the last 4 or 5 years to fundamentally change the U.S.-Iranian relationship. After September 11th, there were 1 million Iranians in the streets of Tehran in support of the United States. We had tremendous sympathy from the Iranian people, and it was just as you say, it was merging with this reform movement in Iran. There were possibilities right then to aid Khatami, then the reformist president of Iran, and help him. And even after Iraq, there was a lot of fear and trepidation in the Iranian government that they were going to be next. And there was a lot of neoconservatives in Washington, you remember, in May of 2003 and that summer, talking about moving on to Damascus and moving on to Tehran. And there was a moment where we could have turned that to our political advantage and reached out and changed the relationship. But the president wasn't interested. The administration wasn't interested. They were going to topple the regime. So that moment passed. The reformist president lost his political mandate, and we've gotten a swing to the extreme in Iran now, and we're paying the price for it.
Well, it's interesting to note that the CIA chief analyst who just retired, Paul Pillar, who was himself a recipient of a hit job done by Robert Novak, the reporter who outed Valerie Plame, and who is now speaking out about the cherry-picking of intelligence, the main point he's making is that the White House had made up their mind to go after Saddam, and their main focus was on selling and manipulating the American people into accepting a war and making Saddam seem like he was a worthy candidate for a war by exaggerating the threat that he posed. But no thinking was done on the strategic implications of both an invasion of Iraq and the aftermath of, everybody knew that the United States was going to beat Iraq. They did it already once in 91, so that was a no-brainer. But nobody thought about the aftermath, and obviously nobody thought about how the destroying Saddam's regime would strengthen Iran's influence over Iraq, and thirdly, what we're just talking about, how it would undercut the Iranian opposition. So, I mean, here we are in a situation where we're saber-rattling against a hardline regime which is just playing right into their hands when a few years ago, with a little deft maneuvering, we might be able to get the Iranian people themselves to get rid of these mullahs.
That's exactly right. It's really astonishing how inept the Bush administration policy has been on Iran. They really have not had a good strategy of how to deal with it. They still don't. I mean, when we just talked about the military aspect, the Joint Chiefs understand this. I don't hear a lot of talk from the military in Washington for doing this. I don't think the senior administration really wants to do this. They still want to use it sort of domestically, but they don't have an answer for how to solve this problem. And this article you just referred to just was posted on the internet this weekend. It's coming out in the next print edition of Foreign Affairs. But if you go to foreignaffairs.com, I guess, .org, you can read it. It's a fascinating article. I just took a look at it, and he says exactly what you described. There were intelligence failures, but that was not why we went to war. And he details from the insider's view how the pressure was put on to cherry-pick the intelligence, to find the analysts who agreed with them and elevate them and elevate their analysis until they had a case for going to war to do what they wanted to do in the first place. It wasn't the threat assessment that drove them to war. It was the decision to go to war that drove the threat assessment.
And just in closing, Joseph Etzioni, what I was talking about an October surprise, obviously with some irony, given that that's what Ronald Reagan was expecting from Jimmy Carter, and we know all that sort of history. But if the White House, if the writing were on the wall that the Republicans were going to lose the House and Senate in October, what could they do short of going to war? I mean, it doesn't take much to get war fever. It doesn't take much to get
right.
Fox News salivating.
Well, that. That's exactly right, and actually a lot of the media play into this. The Washington Post editorials are no better than the Fox News headlines on this, although perhaps it was a little less music and you know, countdown on Iran kind of talk. And CNN plays into this, too. This is a media problem we have of how the media want to keep viewers before they hit the switch. Karl Rove, back in the election of 2002, told the Republicans to run on the war and the economy. The economy tanked, so they just ran on the war. And you may remember, we didn't invade in 2002, but we had the votes in Congress on authorizing the president during this fever pitch, and the manipulated intelligence came out. This year, he's also telling Republicans they're going to run on the war. He's not even really talking about the economy anymore. Social Security, the domestic agenda's gone. So the political agenda of the Republican Party is driven by the war. So the danger is that this thing gets out of hand, that while they may be using it primarily politically, primarily rhetorically, this is how wars start. You know, this is how we stumbled into World War One.
The March of Folly.
The March of Folly. Officials not understanding the motivations of the other party, making miscalculations, not having good intelligence, and sometimes the rhetoric gets carried away, a false step is taken, and the balloon goes up.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Joseph Etzioni.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Joseph Etzioni, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and the author of Deadly Arsenals. And as you mentioned, he was one of the few Westerners who was given access to the Iranian nuclear facilities, particularly the enrichment facility that's in question here, that may lead to UN sanctions against Iran. And he was just in a conference in on this issue in Geneva, and he's making his way through the snow blizzard there. And I believe Greg Speeder, our next guest, has been stuck in the same blizzard in Minnesota. And Greg Speeder is the executive director and founder of the National Priorities Project in Washington, D.C. The National Priorities Project studies the federal budget and policy priorities and provides information on how the budget is created, how it works, and how it impacts citizens. And, of course, with this budget that President Bush has just presented has a record-breaking $440 billion for defense, which does not include the supplementals of the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan, which the Nobel economist Joe Spiegelman thinks could top $2 trillion. So how do they get away with this, Greg?
Well, that's a good question. I think that I've talked to a lot of people who just sort of feel powerless, but I'm also talking to people who have some numbers in front of them now and are now able to make arguments. But, you know, I think they've been able to fan the flames of insecurity and make us think that this is a war that we need that's going to increase our security. And I think we've seen very clearly that it's really decreased our security. And I think, you know, people get confused by the numbers and they get overwhelmed. And what we've tried to do is kind of break that down so that people understand exactly what that means to their community. So, you know, what we're spending, this $440 billion before we spend money on the war, you know, we're trying to say, you know, this comes at a cost, and not only at a cost that we have to pay, but it also means that people in California and Los Angeles are not going to get money for housing and for community development because those programs are being cut and WIC programs are being cut, and we won't have enough money for health care. So we've tried to say, how much does this war cost? And, for instance, this war has cost Los Angeles already $2.7 billion. It's cost them about $1 billion just this year. And
Explain that. How does it directly impact citizens here in Los Angeles?
Well, I mean, first of all, you're paying for that in taxes, and and if you, let's suppose we put that in something else, and if you decide to spend that $1 billion elsewhere, you could have built 6,000 housing units. You could have hired 16,000 teachers. Each day, it costs Los Angeles taxpayers $2.7 million. That's enough to spend each day health care for 1,600 kids who don't have health insurance. So I think when we take a look at what this thing is costing us at the local level in taxes and what we're not able to buy, I think that that's one way that the people can be able to think, well, is this really where we want our money to go? And the cost, the war costs are increasing. They're not decreasing. And so who knows how long this is going to last. But it clearly has taken the energy away from, you know, a lot of other things that people feel important, jobs and health care and housing and education.
Well, it also, I think, exposes what a fraud Donald Rumsfeld is, because he's the guy that said that he wanted to reform the Pentagon and make it lean and mean and adaptable to this new 21st century subnational and transnational array of threats out there, where stateless people like the Al-Qaeda have replaced the great Red Army. But nevertheless, we're building a war machine to fight the non-existent Red Army. We have a Cold War military budget that is funding the F-22 Raptor, which is a complete huge multi-billion dollar waste of money. This is nothing out there to challenge the U.S. air superiority, and furthermore, they don't use these planes as fighters anymore. They use them as bombers. You've still got the F-18 program going, and you've also got the Joint Strike Fighter program. You've got these useless, expensive destroyers. You've got more submarines. When there's just so many submarines, they don't know what to do with them. They're converting them to special forces operations, which is an amazingly expensive platform to drop a couple of guys on a beach. So then you've got National Missile Defense, which was a major, major boondoggle against North Korea, the great threat that we have from that decrepit regime. So this is the part of it that I find shocking, is that these people don't even justify their own war on terror rhetoric.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we are spending both, you know, money for new technology, and we're spending money on an enemy that no longer exists. And you're right. I mean, the F-22, just one of those jet fighters is a $330 million piece of equipment. You could build 3,000 housing units for one jet fighter. So the next time you see an F-22 flying overhead, just think that could be 3,000 housing units. We also spend an awful lot of money on nuclear weapons. We spend $17 billion on nuclear weapons. Only $1 billion of that goes towards trying to buy up old Russian nuclear weapons. So, you know, the real threat, I think, that both the presidential candidates talked about in 2004 was the potential of a terrorist getting hold of some former Soviet nuclear weapons. And we do have a program to buy up those nuclear weapons, but we totally underfund that. So we tend to spend, when we take one thing to do might be to take a look at national security as a concept and not only see that as war making and military, but also take a look at prevention and at defensive measures. And if you define national security in those three categories, we are totally overbalanced on the military and war aspect of it. About 90 cents out of every 89 or 90 cents out of every national security dollar goes to military and to war, and, you know, maybe about 6 cents goes to homeland security, and about 4 cents goes to a variety of other things that might prevent war, such as non-proliferation, such as establishing international organizations, economic development. There are other ways that we could address our role in the world other than military. We spend as much on the military as the rest of the world combined. And I think, that we're putting all our eggs in the basket that is clearly blowing up in our faces at this moment.
But Greg Speeder, it's worse than that. When you say we're spending more than the rest of the world combined on military, we're not so much spending, we're borrowing the money from our economic rivals, principally China and Japan, in order to finance this profligate spending, which is all, so much of it is totally wasteful and unproductive. But we're going to have to be, you know, our grandchildren are going to be servicing this debt. We're maxing out our grandchildren's credit cards.
Well, that's true, and you know, I think that that's another argument that, that people need to address. You know, I will say that we spend a lot of time working with grassroots groups around the country. We try to provide this information on our website at nationalpriorities.org so that people can have information about their own community and about their own states. And we put out a release just 3 days ago on the impact of the president's budget so that by state, so that people can take that information to their elected official and say, you know, I'm not sure that this makes sense. One of the things that I'm encouraged about, and you were talking about these Cold War weapons, is that people are beginning to think that we need another kind of national security policy. And there seems to be a growing movement among some progressives, at least, to really begin to rethink national security and to put some stuff down on paper. And there is something called the Unified Security Budget that some people have put together that really talks about taking at least $60 billion out of the current budget, and you know, because that doesn't provide any kind of security. And in fact, there is another organization that is setting up a common, what is called a common sense budget. And Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream is behind this policy that the Progressive Caucus and others are working on, which would basically cut $60 billion worth of Cold War weapons and nuclear weapons and ballistic missile defense and put that money into education and Head Start and health care and other programs. So people are beginning to see that there are alternatives and that we ought to begin to focus on a different direction. And I think that that's encouraging that that's beginning to happen.
But you could also make the case that if you took the money from, the F-22 Raptor, which is a major, major boondoggle, along with the Joint Strike Fighter and the F-18 upgrade, the destroyers, the submarines, the aircraft carriers, none of which are needed, all of which, I mean, if you took even a fraction of that money and invested it in solar and wind power alternatives, biodiesel, ethanol, whatever your menu of choice is for alternative energy, you'd be doing more for the national security of this country than any of these useless Cold War weapons could ever do, because even the president himself, although he wants it both ways, he admits that we're addicted to oil, doesn't give us any way out. But the long and the short of it is the reason that we're spending all this money in Iraq and in the Persian Gulf is because of oil. And we're going to spend more. And the more that we spend, the more insecure that region becomes, the higher the price of oil becomes. So we're actually, creating our own nemesis there.
Well, I agree that we are. And I think that's something that many grassroots groups in the peace movement and many people in the environmental movement have been talking about for years, and quite frankly, I think, you know, that even the president has had to admit that.
Yeah, but I'm saying that can't we form a coalition between the defense hawks and the tree huggers? In other words, we've got something in common here. We need to go green. It's a national security imperative.
I agree, and I think, you know, that there are projects like the Apollo project that are attempting to do this, and I think that there are certainly, you know, a number of different kinds of organizations that would support this, and I think that would be, you know, another way to talk about national security accidents that some people are beginning to talk about. So I think, I think that makes sense, and I think if you take a look at something called the Apollo project, I think that's the beginning of that, whether there are enough hawks on that level of discussion, I'm not sure, but I think it certainly involved some labor movement people and the environmental movement and members of the peace community.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Greg Spieder.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Mestis. I was just speaking there with Greg Speed, who's the Executive Director and Founder of the National Priorities Project in Washington, D.C. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the assistant producer, Carol Coote, the associate producer.